Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Ryan Carson, and I represent Comcast Corporation in this appeal. If it may please the court, I'd like to reserve 2.5 minutes for rebuttal.
Hey, I'll try to remember to remind you when that we get to that point.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, this appeal arises out of a case and a companion appeal, which was 09CA-1831. In that companion appeal, and I'd rather avoid getting into the details or the underlying facts, they're quite lengthy, but in that companion appeal, the issue was really very narrow. The trial court found that two insurance policies issued by National Union Insurance, a primary carrier, and an excess policy issued by Federal Insurance Company, which was a follow foreign policy, whether it provided coverage for certain expense fees and costs incurred by Comcast. The trial court found, just by reading the insurance policies themselves, that they were clear and unambiguous and there was no coverage. This court recently affirmed that decision for the same reasons. Simply by reading the insurance policy and a couple of attachments to the policy, this court found that there was no coverage. Notwithstanding the very narrow, limited issues in that case, the insurers sought $287,472.28 in costs after the trial court entered its summary judgment order. The trial court then entered its order on March 19, 2010, awarding the insurers essentially the entire amount of the cost that they were seeking, or $283,963.22. National Union was awarded $131,763, and Federal was awarded $155,708.69. This appeal involves two issues, Your Honors, and the issues are fairly straightforward. One is whether or not the trial court's order was adequate, as set forth by the standards in the case law and the statutes. And the second issue is whether or not the particular categories of costs that the insurer sought in this case were properly recoverable. We would submit that the answer to both of those questions is no. I'd like to briefly address the first issue, and that is the adequacy of the trial court's order. This court has specifically held several times that, notwithstanding the fact that a trial court's order on costs is reviewed for an abuse of discretion, the trial court is still required to make sufficient findings of fact and conclusions of law to support costs that are awarded and to support the amount awarded. This court has also held several times that the opposing party, in this case that would be Comcast, is entitled to ensure that the trial court makes sufficient findings of fact and conclusions of law. And the reason is very simple. This court wants to know what the basis of the trial court's order was and whether or not the costs were reasonable and necessary. And those are the two linchpins, whether they're reasonable and whether they're necessary.
So, Mr. Carson, let me ask you, and maybe you can clarify for me, how specific do these findings need to be that you're talking about? I mean, we have an order here that says, trial court concludes these all are reasonably and necessarily incurred. This case is extremely complicated. It involved millions of dollars at issue. I agree with you that we need to have enough so we can exercise our appellate authority to review for abuse of discretion. What more do I need to know? The court, very complex case. I'm familiar with the case. I've looked at reams of paper and charts from both sides that detail pretty much every specific cost item. They were very impressive on both sides. What else do we need to know as an appellate court to review it?
Well, Your Honor, what you need to know is what analysis the trial court conducted, why the trial judge believed that the particular categories of costs are reasonable and necessary. Again, the standard is the trial court is required to make sufficient findings. Findings in the order itself. So the trial court is required by this court and by the case law to articulate specific findings as to the particular categories of costs that the prevailing party is seeking in this case.
So is the issue here that the court didn't, and I think we all can agree, the court didn't specifically mention computerized research expenses. Is the issue from your perspective, or where the court failed, is it didn't say copying cost? I find these to be reasonably necessary because X. computer cost. Is that where you're saying where the court failed?
Well, it goes further than that, Your Honor. That is certainly one argument that we have. Because what the trial court did here is, instead of even referencing a number of the costs, for example, you brought up the computerized research costs, what the court did is lumped broad categories of costs together. The trial court, for example, said experts were necessary, deposition transcripts were necessary, and et cetera. And I'm quoting that from the court, the et cetera part. The trial court also said things like travel was necessary, copying costs were necessary, and the like. And it's difficult to know what particular categories of costs fit within the and the like or the et cetera category.
Mr. Carson, in your brief, I think you say that the trial court didn't review the cost papers, but I think that the trial court's order, if I remember correctly, said that it did. So if the trial court, assuming that I'm giving me the benefit of the doubt that the trial court did in fact say that, can we rely on that to conclude that the trial court considered all of the costs submitted?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the standard requires more than that. The standard isn't that the trial court's required to review the supporting invoices, for example, or the supporting records in support of particular costs. The standard is that the court needs to take one step further, and that is that the trial court is required to make sufficient findings of fact and conclusions of law in its order. And the way we see this, Your Honors, is that the trial court really has two options. The trial court can issue an order in which the court articulates the sufficient findings of fact and conclusions of law, or the trial court can hold an evidentiary hearing, whether it's requested, and in this case it was not, whether it's requested, or the court can sua sponte order a hearing. There's ample support to show the trial court has discretion to do that and make its findings of fact and conclusions of law on the record. That's an option that the trial court had. Here, unfortunately, because of the limited analysis conducted in the trial court's order, this court is left with guessing what particular categories of costs are reasonable and necessary. And
if I'm having trouble understanding that, Mr. Carson. The court awarded all the costs with the one exception where it took out the overnight courier cost and said, I conclude they're all reasonable and necessary. I don't have any doubt about what the court was saying was reasonable and necessary. And so I guess I'm not understanding your argument.
Well, Your Honor, I think the court should take a look at Federal Insurance versus Ferroglass, Ferrogas case. That's actually a case, and I've got the citation here. That's 961 P. Second 511. That's a case actually cited by the insurers in this matter. And in that case, the court makes clear that merely stating costs are reasonable and necessary without more is insufficient.
But the court did more here. The court said this is a really complicated case and involved millions of dollars, right?
Well, Your Honor, I think the problem that we have in this case is because if the trial court truly, and to answer your question, Your Honor, to go back to your question, Your Honor, if the trial court had truly reviewed the record, and I certainly don't know if the trial court reviewed the record or not, the argument that we raise, though, is that there's no indication in the order itself that the trial court reviewed the record because there's so many discrepancies in the record itself. If the court had reviewed the record, the court would have seen, for example, and if I may, Your Honor, to address your question with a few examples. In the order, for example, not only does the trial court lump broad categories of costs together without sufficiently explaining the basis in terms of findings of fact or conclusions of law as to those categories of costs, the trial court awarded Federal Insurance, and I misquoted earlier, it's $152,199.63 in costs with no analysis whatsoever. The court did not conduct, Judge Gabriel, any analysis as to Federal Insurance. Instead, what the trial court did is it simply said, well, because many of the costs that Federal Insurance is seeking are similar to the costs that National Union Insurance is seeking, then I'm simply going to incorporate my findings, which albeit were limited, as to Federal Insurance. This clearly doesn't satisfy the standards set forth in the GF Gaming case, the Brody versus Hellman case cited in our briefs.
What do you do about Valentine, which division of this court decided January 6th of 2011, and you're probably aware of that case. In Valentine, the division said, quote, because we can infer from the record that the court relied on the defendant's evidence concerning an expert's cost, we conclude the court's finding was sufficient. I mean, this goes to Judge Taubman's question to you. You know, we know there were reams of paper here that with detailed explanations of why all the costs, what they were for. The court, as Judge Taubman also said, states in its order, the court having reviewed the file, the pleadings, and being fully advised. You may disagree, but the court said it read it. And I, for one, I'm not going to discount the court's word. I'm going to take that trial judge at his word. What do you do with that? I mean, why do we have to ignore the fact the court said, I have read everything? The court has hundreds of pages of detail from both sides, wonderfully done. You couldn't do it any better than both sides did in this case. Why can we not presume the court looked at it? And if the court doesn't specifically say, I agree with the insurers, why can't we infer that, as Valentine said?
Well, because in the Ferrogas case, Your Honor, this court also said that the court is required to look at the evidence and to make findings as to the evidence regarding the reasonableness and the necessity of the costs. And again, simply stating that costs are reasonable or necessary is not enough. So that certainly indicates that the trial court is required to take one step further. And that is, the trial court needs to look at the record and needs to make sure that the costs being sought are recoverable. And if I may give you an example. The example here, let's take deposition costs, for example. Here, we've got federal insurance in the record ordering duplicated transcripts of the same witness from the same court reporter in the same case. So in other words, we have evidence in the record, and it's pages 5177 to 87 in the record. We have evidence that shows that they ordered a copy for their local counsel and also ordered a copy for their national counsel. Now, the cost statutes have to limit it somewhere. The General Assembly has imposed limitations on the cost that can be recovered by the prevailing party. Now, of course, the Cherry Creek case does say that the cost statute's illustrative. It's not exclusive. But the standard is always they have to be reasonable and they have to be necessary. That is one example of costs that were not reasonable and not necessary in this case.
Mr. Carson, it sounds to me as if you're making two separate arguments. The first argument that you made a few minutes ago is that the court has to say something about each category of costs. The second thing that you're now saying is that within each category, the court has to address specific issues as to whether certain deposition copying costs, for example, are reasonable. Is that a fair characterization of what you're saying?
It is, Your Honor, in the sense that we are asking, and the case law makes it very clear, that the court is required to take a look at each category of costs. We are not asking that the trial court look at each invoice and comment upon each invoice, as the insurers argue in this case. That's not the standard that we believe applies. But the standard is that the court is required to look at each category of costs and to make sufficient findings of fact and conclusions of law as to those categories of costs. And in this case, had the trial court done that, had the trial court seen that there's a number of discrepancies in the record and that there are costs that are not recoverable under the statute. We have to look at the statutes too, 13, 16, 122. There's a list of costs, and of course the standard is always reasonable and necessary. So that implies that the trial court has to find and has to ensure that the costs are reasonable and necessary. And that's something that this court has to do as well. There's case law that shows that this court is also in a position to be able to look at the record, to be able to look at the trial court's order and decide whether or not the costs being sought in this case, here over $283,000 being awarded, are reasonable and necessary. In the GF Gaming case, for example, which is...
Mr. Carson, I'm trying not to interrupt you. The 2.5 minute mark went by, so I just want to let you know.
I appreciate that. If I may finish answering Judge Talbin's question.
Of course.
And then may I still have the 2 minutes?
Unfortunately not.
Well, let me quickly then address the question. Your Honor, the GF Gaming case makes it very clear that this court is in a position to look at the record, to look at the costs being sought, and make its own determination as to whether or not they're reasonable and necessary. In that case, for example, the trial court awarded certain deposition costs for out-of-state witnesses and also for cancellation fees for depositions. The trial court awarded that. The trial court made findings in its orders. This court, however, reversed that decision. This court said that was not reasonable, it was not necessary, and it wasn't recoverable under the statute. In this case, most particularly, we have a woefully inadequate order that does not satisfy the case law, that doesn't satisfy the standards set forth by this court, and we also have a significant number of discrepancies in the record Comcast overspent on this case. The insurer is overspent on this case. They made the decision to do the discovery that they wanted to do, and they're now trying to foot the bill on Comcast. There has to be a line drawn somewhere, and unfortunately, the trial court didn't do that. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Carson. Seems by process of elimination that you'd be Ms. Shoemaker coming up. I'd appreciate it letting me know if you all intend to share time and if you need any help on that.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Jessica Shoemaker on behalf of National Union Fire Insurance Company. We do intend to split time. My intention is to split equally with Mr. Ingebretson, Federalist Counsel, so I will take the first 7.5 minutes, and Mr. Ingebretson will get the remainder. All of the costs that were awarded in this case are permitted by law, down to the discretion of the district court, are reasonable in the context of the facts and issues at issue in this case, and are more than sufficiently supported by the record. The district court, the standard is that the district court is required to make sufficient findings so that this court can understand the basis and the amount of the award at issue. Comcast is trying to impose a new heightened standard that this court has not ordered. There is no authority for this requirement that Mr. Carson is arguing for. In fact, the federal versus Ferlinga's case that he cited in his argument is not on point at all. In that case, the district court had entered a cost award without issuing any findings, and there was also no evidence whatsoever in the record. There was no documentation, no evidence to support the reasonableness of any of the costs. So in that case, when there's no findings and there's no evidence, certainly this court could not review what the district court had done. That's not the case that we have here.
Ms. Shoemaker, I understand Mr. Carson's argument, at least part of it, is that the court should at least specify the categories of costs, and the court didn't do that here. Is your position that a court is not required to at least specify the categories in which it's awarding costs?
I don't think that there's any support for that being a sort of technical requirement that the district court has to artificially go through every category of cost and say postage, mailing, long distance telephone charges, separately discuss each and every item. That certainly, there's no cases that have reversed for a failure to do something like that in the district court.
Well, then I'm not sure that I understand your position. Would it be sufficient for a trial court to say, I have reviewed the voluminous pages of costs that have been submitted, and I find that they're reasonable and necessary, period, and that would that be sufficient?
That's not our case here.
I understand that, but I'm asking
you. But I think that in some cases that could be sufficient. If there is a voluminous record that adequately supports exactly what was at issue, exactly what costs were required, exactly what the arguments for supporting each cost were, and there's no question about the amount that the cost that the court ordered, so that you know that the court ordered all of the cost as requested, I think that could be sufficient. But here we don't have that case. Here the district court did carefully review the record. I find it surprising that Mr. Carson does say in his briefs that there's no indication that the district court did review the record. And as you mentioned in your questions, Judge Stern specifically says in his order, having reviewed the file and the record and the pleadings. And not only does he say that, he describes the documentation as painstakingly detailed and documented, which in fact it was. Not only did we submit, National Union submitted more than 500 pages of new record evidence supporting each and every cost item requested, Federal Insurance also submitted another 563 pages of new documentation. Both of the bill of costs in this case were sworn and verified by the attorneys who had done the bulk of the discovery below. And so those verified sworn bill of costs also laid out the specific cost requested, the specific authority for each item, what the purpose of the cost was, and why it was reasonable and necessary in this particular case.
So I gather, I guess I'll push Judge Talvin's hypothetical some. If the court here, in a case where you have, as you argue, detailed explanations for why each cost was reasonable and necessary, the court, I guess in your view, could say, I've reviewed everything and I agree with the defendants. Period.
I mean, I think that that's possible. I think that's probable. Having reviewed the record, you are able to look at the record and the order itself. But again, that's not what we have here.
But the case, and so the other extreme, I gather, based on your own, there could be 10 million pages of documents, which are a whole bunch of numbers on the page. No explanation on what they're for or whatever. In that case, would you agree that the court would err if the court said, I award all those? Period.
Well, if there's not sufficient documentation, then certainly that's something that this court could look at and could review that documentation and decide whether there's adequate, whether that was an abuse of discretion.
In other words, all there is in my hypothetical are numbers. You got a whole bunch of pages. You're talking about 500. I'll confess I'm not so persuaded that it was 1,000 pages on each side. That doesn't move me. I'm more moved by the fact that there are explanations. Mm-hmm. But so in my if there are a million pages and they're just a series of numbers, here's copy and charges with no explanation for what they were for or anything, no verification, wouldn't you agree that the court would err if the court said, we conclude reasonable and necessary with no backup, no explanation?
I think where there's no backup, that's where you have federal insurance. So when there's no findings and no backup, then federal insurance does hold that that's an insufficient finding and that the district court, there's nothing for this court to review in that circumstance. But again, that's nowhere near what we have in this case. In this case, we have detailed explanations and documentation of each and every cost that was requested. And the district court did make findings. The district court not only said that he had reviewed the records, but indicated his review by the substance of his ruling. So he specifically referenced, for example, the copy charges and said, in my analysis of the documents, I see that there's a range of costs from X to Y, and I think that that's reasonable, indicating that he had, in fact, reviewed and carefully thought about all of these documents.
Well, I would grant you that's true for that item, but the trial court did not say, I have reviewed the deposition transcript costs and determined them to be reasonable. And so I'm not sure how we can tell whether the trial court actually reviewed it in detail and thought it was reasonable, notwithstanding the objections by Comcast, or whether the trial court simply glossed over it.
Well, I mean, I think that when the judge says he reviewed the record, I'm, you know, inclined to give some deference to the fact that he's telling the truth.
We do too.
And certainly an abuse of discretion standard here, the review is whether it's manifestly arbitrary, unreasonable, and unfair. And I don't think there's anything in Judge Stern's order that even approaches that standard here.
But by the same token, though, if we just gave deference without anything further as a requirement, there would be no need for the case law to say that the trial court judges must set forth their findings with specific details so that an appellate court can review them. Because otherwise, all the trial court would just have to say is, I've reviewed the costs and they're okay with me. And then we would say, yes, we defer to the trial court. And then that would be the end of it.
But again, that's not what we have here. So the primary argument that Comcast made below was similar to what we heard Mr. Carson start the argument with, which was that this was a simple insurance contract case. There was no need for discovery into the underlying litigation, which was complicated. It was $1.5 billion transaction involving a sale of interest in the communications industry between AT&T and Comcast. The district court was deeply familiar with the facts of this proceeding, and that's where he said that the discovery into those underlying litigation was reasonable. He did make that finding, and that was Comcast's primary objection to the transcripts below, was that they were, we didn't even need to talk to the director who was at issue in the underlying case, the director who was Brian Roberts, who's the person for whom they sought coverage, that we didn't even need to discuss him because it wasn't relevant. And Judge Stern specifically found that we did because the underlying cases were properly subject to discovery. And I am out of time. I'm going to save the rest for Mr. Ingebretson.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, Kirk Ingebretson, number 11444. The standards that I believe do apply are outlined in the City of Aurora case, where we have to provide sufficient information and supporting documentation for the judge to make a reasoned decision. And secondly, the trial court, in its order, must make specific findings on the reasonableness of total costs in each category. With respect to a federal and its bill of costs, the court order satisfied that standard Every category was mentioned except for one, which was the miscellaneous category. And we believe, under the facts of this case and the judge's order, that the standard was nonetheless met with regard to that, because the only cost which was disallowed was about $3,000 in Federal Express charges under the miscellaneous category, showing the court had in fact reviewed that category and then held in the general sense that after reviewing all the different categories, held that those costs were necessarily incurred and reasonably incurred. The court order also made a point of noting that he took a special look at the federal bill of costs because the costs were about $20,000 more. And so I think the court has enough in the order to take comfort in the judge's statement that he did review the file and the pleadings and was fully advised in having reviewed in some detail the over 1,000 pages of documents, invoices, and explanation in support of the defendant's bill of costs. Briefly, I wanted to explain the review, the specific factual findings that Comcast counsel says were never made. In the court order, Judge Stern specifically found that all costs, other than those Federal Express costs, were reasonably and necessarily incurred. He said the costs were painstakingly detailed and documented. He held that Comcast's argument that the counsel did not coordinate well was incorrect and the result of sour grapes. He held it was impossible to be perfectly efficient in the context of voluminous discovery and complex litigation. He held that the documents relating to the underlying litigation, which is where the bulk of the copying charges arose, were, quote, legitimately discoverable, something he had previously ruled on during the course of the litigation. He noted that there were millions at stake in legal fees. He noted underlying litigation was, quote, immensely complex. He held that the defendants were well within their rights to demand discovery from all the underlying cases. He held each defendant was entitled to have its own copies of those documents. He held that experts were a necessity, not reasonable, a necessity. The travel was a necessity. All the witnesses we deposed and all the documents we had to review were produced by Comcast in Denver, Colorado, the forum they chose. They only produced them in Pennsylvania or in New York, so we had to fly to go there. That's why travel was a necessity, according to Judge Stern. Why depositions, video or not, were a necessity, another specific finding. The certifications we obtained were a necessity, he held. And the reporter fees were a necessity. He held that the defendants did cooperate because they jointly hired experts, retained who had been retained in one of the underlying cases, the Williamson case, which was a huge cost savings because both of those expert reports, for which we didn't have to pay, were over 100 pages long. Now, we had to pay them to do supplementary work using those as foundations, but it was a huge saving there, and we jointly retained them. And the judge found that as evidence of our cooperation. He noted, as Ms. Schumacher pointed out, that there were variance in per-page copying costs, but that was the result of the different locales where the copies were made. He made a finding that there was no evidence the defendants had built any profit into their copying costs. And he held that despite Comcast has argued repeatedly throughout this case that as a excess carrier who issued a follow-form policy, and their contention as a result, Federal did not have the right to defend itself, and they're seeking $25 million from it, didn't have a right to oppose summary judgment motions, file their own summary judgment motions, didn't have a file to make a copy of a document, that they lived and fell by the fortunes of National Union. He rejected that and said, and he held, there's no persuasive reason to treat Federal's costs any different from National Union's. We believe that the standard of providing sufficient explanation and documentation for the court to make a reasoned decision, that standard was met, and that the court, having specifically ruled on every category of costs with regard to the federal bill of costs, with the exception of the miscellaneous category, and I would explain why I believe that standard still has been met.
Mr. Ingebrigtsen, yes. What about computerized research costs? Right. Was that within the miscellaneous category?
It was not. It was on the national. The federal did not have any computerized research costs, okay. Your Honor. So that was a National Union expense. I still would contend that it's recoverable, and the reason I think is based on, the Valentine case, the one you can infer based on the record, and the information relating to that was in the record, that showed that it was separately billed from the attorney's expenses, the verified bill of costs submitted by National Union. that it was specifically related to this case and not general overhead expenses, that there was enough information there, together with the judge's general conclusion, all costs, except with the exception of the Federal Express costs, were necessarily and reasonably incurred. Finally, I just want to give a little context to the need for expert witnesses and the need to copy a lot of these documents in the underlying litigation. This entire lawsuit arose out of 5 underlying suits. Because of those suits, Comcast incurred $12 million in legal fees and $40 million in settlement costs. They turned around and sued my client and the Shoemaker's client for those costs, and then contended that we weren't permitted, because it was, in their view, irrelevant and immaterial, to take a look at those underlying suits to see if the $12 million in legal fees they were seeking were reasonably incurred, and secondly, whether or not there were any defenses relating to that. And there were. We alleged affirmative defenses, which I know the plaintiff, Comcast, never gave much credence to. But if we had not prevailed on summary judgment on the interpretation of Endorsement 8, unfortunately we did, but if we hadn't, we would have gone to trial. At the end of the case, Comcast wouldn't have won. We would have gone to trial. We still had the right to prove our affirmative defenses, including the ill-gotten gains, lack of allocation defenses, and all that discovery related to those affirmative defenses. They were necessarily and reasonably incurred for that reason, and Judge Stern made specific factual findings to that effect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We thank all counsel in this case, and I would actually echo the comment that I made in the prior argument. I know I speak on behalf of my colleagues in saying we appreciate the professionalism that we witnessed throughout not only this appeal but the prior one. I know I went out of my way to point that out, although in an unpublished opinion, I would have loved to plaster that on the wall for every counsel to see. It's a pleasure to see that kind of professionalism in this court and in the bar generally. So we thank you all for that. The case will stand submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course, and that can